Students' number one question that always comes back to me is like, is this okay? And it's such a weird question, especially in a design school environment, because of course, it's like, is that really all you want to be? Okay? Like, is that what we're headed for? Is okay?
Hi, you're listening to More Right Than Wrong, a podcast where we wrestle with opposing tensions in the workplace, especially as creatives and as women. We're also figuring out how to make decisions that are more right than wrong. I'm Rachel Yu.
And I'm Angie Lee. So today we're tackling a topic that's really near and dear to my heart, which is the notion of good enough versus perfection. And in thinking about who we could invite to this conversation, one person immediately came to mind, Juliet Cesar, longtime friend of mine. And I think she's in a really unique position because on one hand, she's run her own practice for nearly two decades, and her client list is like a who's who amongst amazing design. She includes MoMA, the New York Times, the Metropolitan Museum of Art. But she's also a longtime professor at Parsons, where her role is really to help train the next generation of design leaders. So on one hand, she has clients who are literally setting the bar for design, and every pixel needs to be in the exact right place. And then she spends her days teaching students on how they can use their craft to help solve better design problems. When you think about then those two polar opposites of having one that's really focused on perfection and one that's really focused on good enough, we wanted to invite her in to kind of share her viewpoint on this. So let's get started.
Juliet, I have heard so much about you from Angie, and I would love to hear your take a little bit on your journey, your professional journey, about what it's looked like to get you to where you are now, and a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I was the type of kid in high school who was really good at math and really good at art. And I thought that math plus art equaled architecture.
And it's totally the same.
And I thought that perhaps I would do that. And I really loved architecture. I went to architecture school. I loved architecture school. But after a few years, I realized that architecture is about buildings and making buildings. And I wasn't actually as interested in buildings as I was in math and art. And I also was more interested in books. And I loved books. And so when I graduated and I moved to New York, I looked for positions where I could be more like still in the architecture field, but really working on books and publications, and which is what I ended up doing. But even when I was doing that, especially near the end of my time, I worked for Peter Eisenman, the architect, like when I first graduated from school. And after I left the office, he would say, like, why don't you just be a graphic designer? And I'd be like, graphic designer? Like, that seems like bad. Like, I pictured, you know, logos and coupons for some reason. Like, it didn't seem like any of like the stuff that I loved. I didn't think of the people making them as being graphic designers, you know, things like books or museum displays and things like that. Mm-hmm. About a year later, I was working at MoMA, and my associate director there, she kept saying, like, why don't you go to graduate school in graphic design? And I would say, well, you know, me and architecture, we're going to get back together. It's going to be fine. Like, I'll go to graduate school in architecture. It's no big deal. But after a while, I just thought, you know, I actually really like these people. Like, they're not assholes. And so I said, okay, well, I'll apply to graduate school and see if that works. And if it does, like, maybe this is something that I'll commit to. And it would be like one more little piece of like, yeah, maybe you should do this, you know, if I did that. So I went to grad school for graphic design. And ended up running my own studio for a long time. I was teaching the whole time after grad school. And at some point, I saw a post for the director of the communication design program at Parsons. And it was like the one and only time that I thought to myself, who else would do that? Like, I thought that's got to be me. And so I did that.
Amazing.
That was about 12 years ago. But I never wanted to teach. I should say that too. My father was a professor, and whenever I would accompany him to school and stuff, there was not a single day that I was like, this looks good. Like, I should do this. You know, it just never occurred to me. And clearly he didn't encourage me to do that either. And also when I was a student, I was kind of a terrible student. So I never looked at my professors and thought, like, that's what I want to do. But once I started teaching, it was really, it's like either you like it or you don't. And I just loved the interaction. I could go and work by myself, you know, for the whole day and then just be incredibly social for a few hours, you know, with my students. Mm. And, you know, so I really took to it.
I just want to point out there's an emerging theme where you've reluctantly fallen into your careers as a graphic designer, as a professor, and you've done pretty well at it, right? I mean, you've built an amazing career around it. What, I mean, when you look back on kind of your mindset about what stood in the way of you actively moving towards it versus falling into it, like what did you learn about yourself in that process?
It's very much relevant to what we're talking about here today. When I first got married, one of the things that my husband pointed out to me, he said, you never play games that you can't win or that you don't know you're going to win. Because he would just say like, oh, you should apply to this thing or you should do this thing or you should go and, you know, and I'd be like, no, I don't know, you know. And one of the ways to avoid that situation is to constantly fall into things, you know, because like then somebody else like kind of comes in and or a situation arises and then you put yourself in the right place at the right time, you know, so to speak. And I wouldn't recommend it as a technique, to be honest. Like, I don't think it's a good way to operate. I do wish that I was more like this is the thing I want to be in 30 years. I'm going to do this thing. At the same time, I mean, and I will kind of squeeze back and forth on this. It's like, at the same time, it is who I am, you know, in a way. So I don't want to, I can't wake up tomorrow and be a person who's like, I'm going to be a brain surgeon, you know. I mean, I suppose I could, but I think it's a little late for that.
So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about striking that balance between good enough and perfections, because that idea of wanting to win or wanting to guarantee the perfectionism can sometimes make us aim lower.
Yeah.
And at the same time, in a lot of cases, good enough is plenty good. Like, because I know my big theme is like under promise, over deliver always. And it's so funny because this topic is so relevant. I'm dealing with this very thing right now in my work. So I hope that you can give me some advice to help, you know.
This is Rachel's therapy session, guys.
It's always
going to turn into a therapy session.
Well, so can you talk about that in the context of some specific points in your career where maybe perfectionism was a little bit of a thorn in your side? Or like, how did you, do you tend to err on that side versus like good enough? How do you balance that?
Well, I mean, in terms of career, it's also, so I, you know, I work in academia and I, you know, I got tenure about 2 years ago or so. And that's a really interesting process to even think about or talk about. Universities are supposed to be these kinds of like very, like much looser than regular companies sort of environments. And like, you have this sort of imagination of what it is, but it's actually the most regulated and bureaucratic of advancement environments. Like the military is probably the only other one that is like as pointed about how you're supposed to advance. It always sets up a really interesting problem because it says the guidelines always say something vague, like show impact on your field. And it doesn't say how much, it doesn't say how, it doesn't say anything. And then you're kind of like forced to interpret that. And in retrospect, I actually think it's a pretty good process, as is, you know, even going to graduate school is a good process for dealing with that kind of ambiguity of expectation. But it can be really, really hard for somebody who is just wanting to know, especially for somebody like me, you know, who just wants to know, well, how many papers do I need to write?
Right.
And it's funny because like now I'm on the mentorship side of that. And I'm the asshole who says like, well, it's not about how many papers you write, you know, and and I don't know how to make this connection exactly, but some of it is not being uncomfortable with being imperfect. Some of it is just being uncomfortable with ambiguity of expectation, which I think is itself really scary if you're not used to being supported, if you're not used to things going well for you. If you're alone in your quest, ambiguity is not your friend in any of it.
One thing that comes to mind for me is the fact that it's sometimes easier to coach others through a challenging thing versus doing it yourself. So I spent years working in media teaching people how to do podcasts. And then it was like, kind of your own. I'm like, oh, this is really scary. And so similarly, when you were talking about, you know, being on the other side of the table and mentoring, do you find that like when students come to you and they say, or you can see in their work that they're struggling with perfectionism or struggling with knowing how to self kind of edit, how do you coach them to understand how to modulate that spread between hitting expectations and then striving for the absolute perfect.
Oh, I mean, first of all, yes, absolutely. Mentoring somebody or seeing what's in front of them and then telling them in clear language that they need to stop doing that is really easy. Mm-hmm. If I could take all of my own advice, I would be a brain surgeon by now, probably. But what's interesting to me, so I teach design, and design's also gotten to a place where we know exactly what people like in design. You know, we have numbers at this point, right? We know when somebody posts something and a lot of people like it. Mm. We can look around in our environment and see like what kinds of design are accepted or celebrated. It's very easy to see and calculate that. And my students in particular too, like they don't try to be outsized in some ways. Like, you know, they're not trying to beat everyone. It's not that kind of thing. But they will, in their most quiet way, do the medium thing, you know, the least noticeable, most acceptable type of design. And I come in and I keep saying to them, listen, like, we're training computers to do this right now. Like, we don't need you to do it. Perhaps you can have some imagination and do something else, you know, other than this. And it's a really hard place to be, because a student's number one question that always comes back to me is like, is this okay? And it's such a weird question, especially in a design school environment, because of course it's like, is that really all you want to be? Okay. Like, is that what we're headed for? Is okay. They've been trained that they have to follow in a certain way, or, you know, they're going to be struck down in some way or another, you know, like it's a really not free mentality.
It's interesting because I actually studied engineering in undergrad, and then I got a graduate degree in design. And I feel like, but one of the things actually is that I love ambiguity. Like, I actually thrive in like blank canvas, more problem solving, co-creating a brief and concepting from scratch. And one of the things that's fascinating, as you were talking about that number one question, is this okay? I felt like one of the big things that we were trying to define in graduate school as our own design voice, where you can answer that question yourself, where it's like, I decide when it's, if it's okay, you know, kind of thing, like to have that stronger point of view. Because I do think, like, in practice, in the commercial space as a creative director, that is largely your role, is to bring in that confidence to the client or to your own team.
No, I mean, I completely agree. What's interesting is that whenever you think of somebody as being headstrong or, you know, opinionated, or like they have their own quirky way of doing things, you think like, oh, they must be working by themselves, like on a mountaintop somewhere. When in fact, like, those are the people that are most often needed in larger contexts.
Yeah.
We graduate about 140 students a year, and I keep up with many of them. And so I have many, many conversations with students after they leave. And it's interesting, like that ability to become invisible, like, doesn't really work well. It doesn't work well in a small environment, but it definitely doesn't work well in a larger one. But it's, you know, again, the person who wants to find the perfect situation in some ways, like, they think like, well, if I'm just in an organized place and I keep my head down and like, I don't, you know, I don't put myself into the work, like, that's going to work out for me. Like, that'll work, right? And again, I'm the person who shows up and tells them that, no, it's not going to work.
But I feel like your job is always to kind of push either way,
yes,
whichever way they need to be pushed. I've been kind of processing and just thinking about how perfectionism and good enough fits in with intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. Because what you're describing is modulating performance according to external rules, right? So
right.
Will people like what I do? Will I get a good grade on this thing? And interestingly, like, I, in my mind, always thought of perfectionism as an internally motivated thing, that you're
totally,
you're driving towards something that you individually want desperately to kind of hit and to get it exactly the way you want. But what I'm hearing you say is like, maybe there's actually a world in which part of it is about balancing both the intrinsic but also the extrinsic kind of inputs. I don't know. How do you think about, or how do you counsel students on intrinsic versus extrinsic?
I think that's interesting, just because I, and again, I've been teaching for a long time, so I've seen a change of things. I think definitely that first model that you're talking about, I mean, it's still there, it's just less so because there is so much external noise at this point. Yeah. Like there's not enough time spent alone with things to like really have that kind of conversation as much as there was 10 years ago, for example. At the same time, students will often also want to, and I guess it's still externally motivated though, to some degree, but like, yeah, they will come in and they'll say, I'm going to solve world peace or something, you know, with my design project. And it's such a weird pressure, like self pressure. And it's almost as if it's meant to be like, they'll set themselves up for that failure basically. So there's almost two sides of the coin, right? So you have the people or the tendencies and the ones that I talked about in myself where you're like, you know, I can't get to the big thing. So I'll just like set my sights a little lower. So I know I'm going to get this. And somehow like that seems to exist simultaneously with, oh, I'm not just going to do a book. I'm going to make a book and I'm going to edit it and I'm going to design it and I'm going to, I'm going to promote it and it's going to be amazing. And there will be TED Talks about, you know, like all of a sudden the scope can be enormous, you know, for some of these things that people set out to do.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to see like, what are the motivations internally and externally that make that happen? And who doesn't do that? Like, which is kind of interesting too, I think. It bleeds into everything. Mm-hmm. So I talk a lot in school, for example, about critique and about how different types of people approach critique. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm always talking about myself when I talk about critique, but it's the idea that you're in a design critique and it's really just a performance and people are supposed to clap when you're done. And this is also a weird thing that happens in school. People clap. It's always been mind-bending to me that that's been a kind of ritual. It's like, here's this moment where you have like the greatest opportunity to have somebody come in and say, oh, wait, I thought this was a banana or whatever, or like give you some sort of crazy piece of information that you just didn't know or understand about the premises, your assumptions about a project entirely. Like here you are and like you could completely receive this gift of new information. And instead, the desire to snap it into like a solo performance where the only positive response is the applause, you know, that there's no, everything else is a bad outcome, is a really interesting dilemma in a way.
I have a burning question for you. As a recovering perfectionist, a fellow recovering perfectionist, when you look back at your work, are you able to celebrate it? Because I have I basically never look at it.
It's very difficult for me because when I hear about the project and a picture shows up in my head of what that thing could be, I immediately just start going running after it. You know, like I'm like, I just want to see this thing happen, like in this particular way. Mm-hmm. And then, but unfortunately, even when the project is done, I still see the original thing that I thought. And so it's really hard for me to say, no, actually, like this is a success because like under these circumstances, like we made this thing, or even better, like under these circumstances, we made anything, you know, right. Sometimes is the win. And yet at the same time, like, and you know, my graduate director used to say this too, like, I do think it's important to be able to look at the things that you make and also kind of love them. But yeah, like it is hard to see, you know, to look at something. Maybe you see that, but it's hard to avoid or ignore the vision that you had of what it could have been, you know, under different circumstances.
I think this is also where you need to ask people for help, in the sense that like sometimes you need to get out of your own head and have someone else explain what they see in your work or like about your work. It is so immensely hard. In the same way, it's like impossible to put together your portfolio, your resume, because there's so much tied into the decisions and the way you talk about it that oftentimes outside people can be useful.
Yeah, and they can also help you understand how somebody else reads what it is that you've put in front of them.
Years ago, I was at an agency and I remember I was working very closely with an art director. We were super frustrated, hitting wall after wall on a rebrand. And he just looked at me one night and he said, you need to care less. You need to care a lot less. And it was so counterintuitive, right? Because we were on the same page of like, we need to solve this thing. We need to come up with like a really smart, beautiful, effective art direction. And And yet I think the actual mental blockage was how much weight I had put on it. You know, like it was almost like analysis paralysis. That was like,
I've destroyed projects with that.
Right. Absolutely. And where you just kind of, you almost like, you like strangle the creative baby.
You can completely strangle it to death.
Like, there's it's horrible. Once we got looser with it, I'm like, let's try that. Let's just experimental. Let's try this. This is ugly. Let's try this one. Oh, this is a little less ugly. Like, you're just going to get somewhere faster. It's like you have to exercise the bad ideas too.
One thing that I do and that I try to also relate, you know, to people who I talk to who have similar issues is, so rather than saying, I'm going to make this perfect thing, what I do is I just make a list of 10 other things that might lead to that. But they're also discrete and they're solvable and they're doable, you know, so it'll be, you know, execute this all in black and white, you know, like not looking for the answer, like not trying to hit the target, but hitting around the target. And to go back to my, you know, my first boss that I had, one of the things that, I mean, he would watch me work and then he would say, you're doing this all wrong because you're trying to find the right answer. And it made absolutely no sense to me. And then he'd be like, I fought in Korea. And I'd be like, okay, well, like, where is this going? And
I'd be like, I love this man already Korea, so much.
like, what's Korea got to do with it? And he was like, if you're trying to hit a target, you wouldn't hit the target. You would hit like way left of the target, and then you would hit way right of the target, and you'd send the guy out to figure out where each of those things landed to figure out where to hit on the target. He's like, if you keep trying to hit the target, you're going to fire in the wrong place, like over and over again, and it is not going to work. And you're going to know that you're failing at doing this, but you're not going to be able to understand where to actually like triangulate and figure out where you're going to be. And it's probably the best piece of design advice like I've ever had in a way.
Profound.
And it's definitely useful for people like me because, yeah, like I make something and I'm immediately depressed because I'm like, this isn't the right thing. You know, this isn't right. So it's easier to kind of say, okay, well, here are 10 parameters, do these things, then look at it. Like whenever we say you got to make a lot of imperfect things, people think it's like, oh, it's like the lottery. You know, it's like you got to play the lottery 100 times and you might hit it. Mm-hmm. But like, that's not really why you need to make a lot of imperfect things. It's like, you have to look at those things and make judgments about them.
As a way to arrive at the end. I think the other question that we wanted to ask was, to what do you attribute your success? It's like, well, a really big one.
There's an assumption that I think I'm successful, you know, in that, which I think I would question entirely. But anything good that's happened, I would say just comes from just having a sense of independence in what I do, of like just kind of being cool with the world in a certain way that is coming from me, not blaming other people or attributing things to other people. I mean, it's a failing as well, but at the end of the day, like, I really appreciate that. So like, my success I would define as being self-reliant, like in a certain way, or like just independent in a certain way. And that in itself like feeds that. Like I feel like at the end of the day, if I, you know, if I'm not going to be design king or whatever, like if I don't achieve some great external thing, at least I will have been doing all of this on my own terms. And like, that's good enough in a way.
I love that. But I'm also going to just add that in the time that I've known Juliet, I would say that one thing that I will brag on your behalf is just the fact that Juliet is immensely humble, incredibly hardworking, and also just generous, like incredibly generous with her time in trying to help others be better, bring out the very best in other people. So I think that your humility comes through, but I would encourage you to brag a little bit more because, damn it, you are successful.
Well, and how apropos that you were like, the last thing that you said was, and I think that's good enough.
Yeah.
I was like, isn't it, Bill? I was like, it is good enough. It's not perfect, but it's good enough.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Juliet was so fun to chat with. I'm really glad, actually, Angie, that you highlighted how humble and successful she is, because that was such an inspiration. What were your key takeaways from our chat with her?
Yeah, it's funny. Every time I talk to Juliet, I feel like I walk away with something new. She's just one of my most favorite people in the world. And she is so humble, but she always just drops these nuggets. And I think the number one thing that jumped out at me was just the contradiction of trying to stand out by blending in. And it rang so true that early in your career, You often think you're going to get ahead by doing what others will see as acceptable, but just trying to be a little bit better than those around. And Juliet's, you know, suggestion that really to get ahead, you have to kind of stand out was such an obvious thing, but was at the same time was also not obvious to me. So I really liked that little nugget of advice.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that stood out to me was it was comforting to chat with somebody else who also has difficulty celebrating their success. And I love the way she articulated it because she sort of was like, we should be celebrating that we did anything at all. So that's that good enough part.
That's so true.
And how easy it is to focus on the original vision of what could have been versus just celebrating what you accomplished under the given circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah. And going into these conversations, I'm often kind of skeptical about whether or not we'll actually come out with something concrete that will help people, like guide people on how they can navigate these tensions.
Yeah.
But I thought it was really helpful when we kind of got into understanding your motivation for your behavior. So is it driven by intrinsic desire? Is it driven by a need for external judgment or approval? And using that as a North Star to kind of really help gauge, okay, when have you hit good enough? And finding that balance, because it's a little bit of both, right? You want to meet the expectations of others or deliver on a solution that will hit a business goal. But then also, can you feel proud and excited to deliver that as an end product? So understanding those motivations is a great framework for me.
Yeah, totally. It's like, how do you even define what is good enough? Or is that, you know, long shot of perfection? It is so easy to want to seek the approval of others. And then a lot of fear comes up versus just having that internal confidence. I personally loved that Korean War story. it was so apropos and relevant to some design challenges my team is going through right now. And I am glad to be reminded of the fact that, like, if you focus too hard on the goal itself, it's really easy to miss it. I mean, super smart in terms of tactics, right? Like the idea that you can actually nail the target if you create these discrete objectives that are achievable in and around that target, and you get kind of closer and closer to honing in on it. That was such a great approach.
I totally agree. I mean, for me also personally, I often think about how doing things good enough can open up more opportunity in other parts of my life. So this conversation around good enough versus perfection was really, really resonant. So thank you again, Juliet, for joining us. We were so excited to have you.
It was so awesome. And thanks everyone for listening. If you want to get in touch with us and chat more about this episode, hit us up on our social channels. And of course, subscribe to More Right Than Wrong if you haven't already, wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to leave us a cute review. Merci.